Later, the alternate.
Thank you.
Okay. Welcome, everyone. I will call the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee to order.
Thank you. The House Revenue Committee will come to order. Paul Warner has some preliminary remarks, and then we'll go straight to the revenue forecast.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple things. For those of you in the audience, we are just releasing the forecast on OLIS now when the chair hits the gavel, so you have to refresh your screen, and it should be there. A couple of things. The reminder to our Senate committee that you will be in recess from 9 till 1 and then come back in at your regular meeting time at 1, and you've got a full agenda. The other thing I wanted to add is that after Office of Economic Analysis goes through the general fund lottery forecast, we have an update on the local school formula revenue and wanted to spend a few minutes with the committees on that. We haven't updated that since the end of the 13 session, so we've got a year change, and so we typically update that once a year once we get the property tax data. So we'll go through that with you real briefly after the revenue forecast.
Okay. And there he is, hiding in the wings. Good morning.
Good morning. Representative Barnhart, members of the committee, thanks again for having us. For the record, my name is Mark McMullen, state economist with the Office of Economic Analysis, and I'm joined today by Josh Lehner, my colleague from the office, to present once again the quarterly economic and revenue forecast. Bottom line is that there's not much change in the revenue picture. Overall revenue picture for the current biennium or for future years. That said, we have become more optimistic about the economic outlook, and in particular, job growth is now expected to be somewhat stronger than we thought 3 months ago, and this is generating additional revenues for the state. Now, unfortunately, those revenues are offset by disappointing collections in the door. What we're seeing come in the door for a wide range of revenue instruments is disappointing relative to our previous projections. Personal income taxes, corporate income taxes, estate taxes, cigarette taxes, court fees. I'm sure I'm forgetting some. But across the board, most of our revenue coming in has been disappointing in the last couple, 3 months. And as a result, while we expect more jobs now in the future, and those jobs will generate more income tax for the state, the overall revenue outlook is largely unchanged. Now, we've become a little bit more optimistic, largely due to a consensus of forecasters both nationwide and within our advisory groups. Here, the first chart I'm showing here is the blue chip consensus forecasts for GDP growth or output growth in 2014 and how they've evolved over time among the 50 forecasting folks in the blue chip group. And you'll see, and this is kind of reflective of what we've seen with our local economists as well, where growth was expected to be healthy or normal at the beginning of 2013, and then as the year went on, analysts became more and more pessimistic about the future prospects until this year, when suddenly a wave of happiness hit. And this is really was also reflected among the Governor's Council of Economic Advisors. They represent a wide range of industries in Oregon, and across many of these industries, times are pretty good, and the council felt that we really should pick up the near-term employment forecast somewhat. So, you know, the upshot of this is we ended up adding about 6,000 jobs in Oregon over the next 18 months, half of which we expect to come from public sector and half of which from the private sector. So, you know, what's behind this? You know, how can we, in terms of working it into our models, what are the explicit assumptions and what's the justification behind what's changed and why people are more optimistic? One clear part is the federal budget situation. The pattern you see here of pessimism is really coordinated along with the dysfunction in Washington, D.C. Forecasters were very pessimistic when the worst of the budget battles were going on, and as soon as a budget deal was reached and that certainty was granted, suddenly we saw a return to optimism for the typical forecaster. And that makes some sense. The budget deal, as it stands, reduced the federal spending cuts by about half relative to the status quo, which was the sequester that they had in place. So in the near term, that would suggest more growth, and particularly growth among federal employees. And so what it also did, the budget deal, is it created certainty. And, certainty is obviously important. I've given the spiel before about business balance sheets and corporate balance sheets being very healthy, and that's a reason for our optimism about the future. In particular, most corporations and most industries are profitable right now and sitting on a bunch of cash. So the question is, when will they chase those profits by expanding, by hiring and investing more? And as a result, picking up the pace of our expansion. Well, uncertainty was a big story there. One reason that businesses weren't sticking out their neck is because there's an uncertain demand environment. They don't know what their sales are going to be like next year. So many became reluctant to expand. So with certainty in the federal budget situation, there's some hope there that some of this potential will be released. So I think in terms of the 3,000 public sector jobs, that's pretty defensible. We have more federal jobs, and even with the 3,000 public sector jobs, we're still looking for very little growth in overall public sector, still not in line with population growth or anything of that sort. So later this afternoon, you'll hear a little bit about an improving local revenue situation, which should shore up some of the local payrolls as well. But for the private sector, there's another reason why maybe, despite the fact that businesses are profitable and sitting on cash, why this expansion they haven't released this to date as we've seen in previous business cycles. Part of it has to do with perhaps they didn't have to, insofar as in many of our industries, production levels haven't reached where they were before the recession. So if I'm a business and I'm still not producing what I did 6 years ago, there's really maybe little reason for me to invest in new facilities and expand. And so, but now, 6 years later, we're starting to see some of these industries get close to where they were before the recession and to get close to some of these capacity constraints. And so this gives us some more reason for optimism that perhaps some of this potential will be released. And Josh is going to go into some of those details.
Thanks, Mark. Mr. Chair, for the record, Josh Lanner with the Office of Economic Analysis. And Mark's absolutely right. You know, you're not going to put in a new plant, you're not going to hire more workers until you're already operating at full capacity or your projections show that you're going to be at capacity soon, and so you're planning ahead. What this graph shows right here is the capacity utilization rate by manufacturing industry in the United States, kind of broken down by all the different subsectors. The bar graph on the right and also the vertical axis on the scatter plot is at what rate historically have you been at capacity where you start increasing that capacity, making that new investment in a new plant, in a new line, some new equipment and software in your firm, where are we relative to that rate historically in terms of where we think some of this business investment will start showing up? And the good news is we're at that rate for at least half of the industries today. Most of these industries are all the way back to where they were pre-recession for the most part. And they're kind of at that break-even point. If the expansion continues, and most people think it will, if their sales continue to increase, there's some certainty maybe around the federal budget situation, now's the time to make that investment. Otherwise, you're going to really hit these capacity constraints across the whole host of industries. And so you look at things on the scatter plot, the two furthest to the right, you have oil and gas industry and also the computer and electronic products. That represents big increases in capacity nationwide and their productions. They've already undergone that. And it's no surprise, given the oil and the fracking that you see in the North Dakota and Montana and the like, that they made big investments in increasing their capacity. Computer and electronic products, that's a story much closer to our home here in Oregon. We know with the Intel expansion in Hillsboro, they have added significantly to their capacity in the last couple of years. Now they just need to start using that and selling more of the products out there. So we're not expecting a whole lot of increased demand from maybe those industries, but all those ones kind of around the origin, maybe some of those green or orange bar industries, those are the ones where we look to see more investment in the near future. They're at capacity, and particularly the metal industry, both the fabricated metal and the primary metals. We have a significant industry, a significant amount of employment in the state of Oregon in those industries, primarily located along the I-5 corridor up in Portland, but then they extend all the way down through Medford as well, and they're all doing really well right now by and large, and the employment's increasing, but their capacity hasn't really increased that much. They're not very far away from that vertical axis, so you expect them to be one of those prime candidates for a next round of investment. Unfortunately, the question becomes, will that investment occur in the U.S. or will that occur overseas? We're reaching domestic capacity constraints, but historically, at least in the last two decades, we've started to see some more and more of this investment overseas. And so to really get this boost to GDP, get this boost to the Oregon economy, we're going to need to see that occur here, occur locally. And there's a number of different factors that we think that there's a higher probability that will occur domestically this time, with exchange rates being much more favorable than they were a decade ago. The U.S. dollar has depreciated in the last decade, so it makes our financing situation in a better place. Labor costs have come down, or our manufacturing wages in a lot of the developing world have shot up dramatically. So the U.S. no longer is in that bad of a labor cost situation relative to a lot of these other nations. And then also energy costs. With the low energy costs in the U.S., with the increase in the oil and gas production in the U.S., it's really going to hit a lot of these industries in terms of keeping their costs down. So there's a lot of positive reasons to invest here domestically and not overseas, and we think we're going to see that. And so if these kind of just increase their domestic production facilities, that's a boost of 0.5% or more of GDP, a few thousand more jobs, and we think that'll that'll provide a boost. The manufacturing cycle has been a big strong point for the U.S. economy and the Oregon economy in particular in recent years, and we expect that to continue.
Thanks. Another reason we might see a boost going forward is this: the labor force dynamics will soon become less bad. The labor force story has been a real bad one in Oregon and elsewhere, where we are losing workers throughout the recovery so far. You see here, Oregon's unemployment rate is dropping rapidly, but doing so largely for bad reasons as much as for good reasons. We're losing workers as much as we're adding jobs, and so this has led to some of this improvement in the rate of unemployment, but not necessarily for the reasons we would like. And there are good reasons to be worried about labor force dynamics. There are real structural problems with labor force participation over time, largely associated with demographic issues. In particular, we have, of course, the retiring of the baby boom population cohort, but in addition to that, we have less participation across a bunch of younger age cohorts as well, pretty much every younger age cohort, with some real pronounced declines among our youngest workers, which really concern us over the long term, and these are going to be problems going forward. But as the new Fed chair mentioned, these labor force dynamics are going to soon be a lot less bad going forward. In particular, some of these workers that have been sitting on the sidelines will choose to come back in, much like our argument that business investment and business capital that's been sitting on the sidelines now has a bigger incentive to be released. We're starting to get to the point where some of these workers sitting on the sidelines will have a bigger incentive to dive back into the labor market as well and support growth. Most of this story with the declining participation rate and the declining labor force, or at least half of it, is the demographic long-term story, but not all of it. Some of it is certainly cyclical. It has to do with job opportunities. People are leaving labor force because they have poor job opportunities. It's difficult to find a job, and that job isn't paying what they require in order to go to work. And so, but this isn't unusual, and this happens in all of Oregon's business cycles, insofar as when jobs are scarce, there are fewer workers, and it takes some time before the before that reverses itself. In particular, you see here, it usually takes 1 or 2 years into the good job growth before we really see a labor force response. In terms of the difference between labor force growth and job growth, the chart on the right, the gap is as large as it's ever been, similar to what we saw coming out of our last severe recession in the 1980s. And we're getting there now. As you saw with the last chart, the unemployment rate, for bad reasons or good, has dropped rapidly, and we're getting under the 7% range. Typically, that once we get around 6.5, that's when we start to see a labor force response. But it takes time. First, you need the unemployment rate to drop, so labor becomes relatively scarce, and then that bleeds through into wage gains. And once you start seeing wage gains accelerate, then almost certainly we see some labor force response. So, like, over the long haul, labor force and the labor force dynamics are still a negative story, but in the near term, it should be less of a drag going forward. So, one more potential reason for optimism would be the spreading of the recovery across the regions in Oregon. And so far, that's really happening and playing out according to script. You see here, in 2011 and 2012, the state was adding jobs at approximately a rate of 20,000 jobs a year. Virtually all of those jobs were coming from the Portland metropolitan area. And now over this last year, as we've seen housing-related industries start to recover and we've seen less cuts in state and local government, many of our other areas in the state are starting to come online and grow as well. So we've increased this growth rate to 30,000, or a little bit over 30,000 a year when we add additional areas to that stable growth we're seeing still in the Portland area. And not surprisingly, the most improvement is being seen in some of our hardest hit areas in the central Oregon and southern Oregon, where we really had the most severe housing downturn, and these economies are the most dependent on housing. As that's come back over the last couple of years, we're starting to see some rapid gains there. So I'm going to pass over to Josh. He's going to talk a little bit about what are the potential for further spreading out, for getting more of our regions online going forward.
That's right. In 2013, late 2012, early 2013, we really saw Bend and Medford come back online, adding growth at a strong rate. You've seen the graph on the left before. They're adding jobs, in Bend at over 5% per year at an annual rate, and Medford 3-4% at a year. So really strong growth coming off of such a severe recession and such a deep bottom. But that's stalled out in the last couple months, and I'll talk about that reasons for that in just a second. But that sort of slowdown in growth in the last couple months has been made up for other parts of the state, in particular Salem. Salem is starting to see really strong private sector job growth today. The public sector is not quite all the way back, but maybe some of the local economies improved, maybe at the start of a new biennium. We started to see some stronger growth here in the Salem metropolitan area. And you can see on the graph on the right, this is, about as good as it has been in Salem in terms of growth rates for over a decade now. You have to go back to the early 90s to see sustained growth rates larger than this. And so Salem also is digging out from a great recession, no doubt. But right now, the trajectory is really good, and that's made up for some of the weakness we've seen in Bend and Medford in the last couple months. And so the question becomes, can we really get all of Oregon's regional economies online? The one that's sort of sticking out a little bit right now is Eugene. Eugene has not been growing that well. They have not been adding too many jobs. They also took a massive recession, and they have not seen the growth that even Salem has seen in the last couple years. One of the reasons for that, we think, would be the structural decline of the RV industry. You take 8,000 good-paying manufacturing jobs out of the Eugene, Lane County, maybe a little bit in Linn County. You take those out of the economy, and that's a structural decline, and those aren't really coming back. And so it takes a while, once you see a severe hit like that, to sort of rebuild and grow and move on from that, not unlike some of the things we saw in the timber industry in recent decades in this state. And so it might be a while before Eugene comes back online. There's a lot of good things going for it, primarily the university. It continues to be a place that people want to move to, both not just college students, but working-age population more broadly. There's some positive things going on in Lane County, no doubt, but when you take a massive massive hit like that, it certainly weighed on some of the growth. Some other areas that we're a little bit more bullish on longer term would be maybe the South Coast with the return of migration and housing and things like that. We'll get our continued influx of migrants, primarily from California, and they like to move to the South Coast, and that will provide some economic activity for Coos and Curry County and the like. So it's really a story of, can we get more online? Right now we have Portland's been going strong for a few years. Bend and Medford are back. Salem is just now joining. So we really need Eugene and some of these other regional economies to come online to get a stronger overall growth, and we feel like we will get that in the next couple of years with the continuation. And with the slowdown in Bend and Medford, it has a lot to do with the housing economy, right? The housing rebound nationwide stalled out in late 2013. We saw interest rates come up. We saw continued home price appreciation that priced out more and more consumers. There's a little bit of sticker shock. You know, when you have interest rates go up a full percentage point and prices rise 10% over the last year, it becomes a lot more difficult and more challenging to finance a house. Not that people can't do it, it's just there's a little bit of sticker shock, and so they took a step back. We saw permits nationwide stall out, housing starts stall out. We also saw sales of existing homes also slow down, all to end 2013. And that was, you know, bad news for the housing rebound. In the big picture, we think it'll be temporary. We think there's 2 or 3, 4 years of good growth left in the housing rebound before we get back to anything approaching a normal level. But what you see in the graph on the left are the housing metros saw the most significant downshift in their housing rebound. These are the 50 worst housing metros in the whole country, of which Bend and Medford are 2 of those 50. And so you can see the blue line, the growth rate differential relative to the nation overall was really strong throughout 2012 and 2013. They were growing much faster. They're improving much more strongly than the national average. But there you go. As soon as the interest rates pop up a full percentage point, down come these housing metros, and this housing rebound has stalled out in a lot of these local areas. One more. And then again, the outlook, the graph is going up and to the right at a good pace, which is the sort of things you like to see in economics graphs. And so we think the housing outlook will be good for at least a few more years. You put all this together, and it leads to a relatively stable employment outlook for the state of Oregon, our baseline for the Oregon economy. You can see here it's a little bit above the last forecast, but it's still within the range of forecasts our office has produced in recent years. The item to point out here is that while the wiggles in the line, the differences in the line might not be much in terms of jobs, or it looks like much on this graph, in terms of, you know, teaching days or in terms of dollars for ways and means in your committee, it can add up pretty quickly in terms of the abilities that you guys can do with that amount of money.
But unfortunately, this time it's not adding up, because while the economic outlook is more optimistic, our revenue outlook has become a little bit more a little weaker, so to speak. As you see here, not much. We're really flat year over relative to the December 13 forecast. These are the combined general and lottery fund revenues for the current biennium. Virtually no change. It says forecast evolution, but it's more like a lack thereof. There haven't really learned much over my 3 years on the job, it appears here. So, but at any rate, we really are looking at a stable outlook, because what's coming in the door has been so disappointing. So it really is offsetting the increased optimism on the employment side. For personal income taxes, the big one, you see here, we've decelerated quite a bit heading into 2014, and this graph would look much even worse for January if not for the federal IRS delaying the processing of returns until the end of the month. Typically, we would have already released a good $40-50 million more worth of refunds at this point through the end of January, where this year those refunds haven't gone out the door yet. So because of timing issues, this should even be worse. The biggest downshift in terms of these personal income tax collections has occurred with the December-January quarterly estimated payment that tax filers make. We've seen really no growth in these quarterly payments, despite quite a bit of underlying income growth. Now, while that's well below our expectation, at least it's better than other states. The typical state seeing their estimated payment drop by 10 or 15% relative to last year. So it's not a phenomenon that's isolated to Oregon, but nevertheless, it's impacted our income tax outlook significantly. Corporate income taxes, or excise taxes rather, have been doing even worse. As you see here, we're down 40% year over year for our preliminary January estimate, and that's a moving average. It's corporate refunds have surged. We've been paying out a tremendous amount of corporate refund payments. In two of the past 3 months, we've sent more money out the door than we've collected in terms of corporate tax payments. Now, some of this has to do with credits against the minimum tax that are now being allowed due to a court ruling. We're seeing some of those get released, and on a smaller scale, a one-time ruling also added some more refunds to that for one particular firm. But nevertheless, when our friends over at DOR dig in and figure out how many of these credits are being cashed in, it's only part of the story, but not nearly all of it. There's a lot of refund increase that appears to be related to underlying profitability and not to the effect of these court cases. So, Dahl, taking a step back, the typical general fund revenue instrument is up about 15% relative to where we were before the recession, but that's not true of all revenue instruments. And so a lot of our dedicated revenue streams haven't come back and are causing some of our agencies and to struggle. And Josh is going to talk a little bit about where we stand.
This graph just shows the dark portion of these bars shows how far these revenue line items fell during the recession. Sort of, 2007, 2008 was the peak. How far did they fall? And then sort of how far have they come back? Where are they today relative to pre-recession levels? And you can see a lot of these different line items, almost darn near all of them, have had some sort of legislative impact in the last decade or so. So that some of these wild swings you're seeing, with Secretary of State filings has to do with increased filing fees. It's not so that we suddenly have twice as many firms in the state registering with the Secretary of State. It's that we have this about the same amount of number of them. They're just paying a little bit more. And so that's why that's up there. You can see the orange bars are the general fund, declined 5 to 10% during the worst of the recession from year to year, and it's about 15%, as Mark said, up relative to pre-recession trends. Personal income taxes, same story. They fell 15-17% during the Great Recession, but they're also 15% above pre-recession levels. That's obviously the largest component here would be personal income taxes. It's no surprise that the general fund total is right next to the personal income taxes on the line. All the smaller line items add up to 7-8% generally of the general fund. The things to point out here would be the ones near the bottom that haven't improved much or improved at all. There's a lot of structural decline issues here, particularly with cigarette taxes. The smoking rate continues to go down, so even though the most recent tax increase was 13 cents, I believe, per pack, even over the extended forecast horizon, we won't see those taxes really, the revenue really increase, just continuing with the trends in smoking habits across the state. A criminal fine account that has both been on somewhat of a structural decline with declining crime rates, but also some of the legislative changes reduced some of these fines and fees. They also increased judicial discretion, which also might also be a downward impact on some of the revenue here. Interest payments, the Oregon University system is no longer able to keep some of their interest payments. They're able to keep their interest payments, and also interest rates are at a rock bottom low, so, we're no longer in that environment of 5, 6%. We're in the environment of 0%, and so the interest revenue has not come back at all. The things to point out would be the potentials for further structural declines. We're talking things like estate taxes and maybe video lottery. Those are ones that have not really come back much in recovery. And video lottery is a little bit of a concern. It's growing 1 to 2% a year. In terms of revenue, our friends at the lottery-funded agencies, they have not seen the rebound that maybe the typical general fund agency has seen in terms of the structural revenues underlying some of the things that support their support their budgets. But video lottery, you know, we've whacked the state and video lottery growth rates down considerably where we were relative to 5 years ago. But there's potential for further downside risk there as, you know, if consumers choose to spend their entertainment dollars on other products out there, be it, you know, other forms of entertainment, I'll just leave it at that, then maybe the video lottery won't improve quite as fast as our baseline projection. So that is a risk that's out there in terms of a state revenue source. State taxes also fall under a similar boat in terms of our CPAs. Our panel of CPAs always talk about how tax professionals are much better at managing the estate tax risk for our high net wealth individuals in terms of gift taxing and things like that. Moving forward, that might not be a source of growth in terms of state revenue. And so those are the ones that sort of on the watch list at the moment, and leave it at that.
Thanks. So, in general, I'll go back to my standard caveat that as an income tax dependent state, all bets are off really until we get April tax season in the door. In the past, we've known as of the fall after our first tax season, so it'll be this September, we've had, if there was going to be a kicker, for example, we've had it in the forecast at that time. Now, this might be a different case insofar as in the past it's always been associated with a real change in the economic environment, a real sharp change in the economic environment. But nevertheless, we'll know a lot more going in a couple of more rounds once we start getting that first tax season in. And the reason the tax season is uncertain is, as always, it's the personal income tax and the tax collections on non-wage income, in particular capital gains and dividends, and these taxable income sources that aren't always realized at the same time that the underlying economic activity took place. When people made the gains in the economy and earned their profits, they don't necessarily cash those in for tax purposes at the same time. So when we have this taxpayer behavior element, it creates a tremendous amount of volatility. So I showed you this one last week to explain, last quarter, to explain part of what's going on behind our outlook for these non-wage forms of income. And as I described then, there is obviously a clear pulling forward of income last year in response to federal tax rates. We saw extremely high realizations of capital gains, dividends, and the like. Here we see now that all the returns for 2012 have been processed by DOR. Here's their final match return numbers. And for our high-income households, as defined by the Measure 66 cutoff, we have capital gains realizations were up 75% year-over-year last year, dividends up 50% year-over-year. Clearly, this isn't sustainable over the extended horizon. So what we've worked in is really flat a real flat outlook for these capital gains in 2013. This is highly uncertain given that we had a booming stock market. By the end of December, our market was up 28% year over year. And typically in Oregon, when we have 28% growth in the stock market, we're going to see a real surge in these April payments. So this pull forward is a real phenomenon. And then you see if equity markets continue to hold on to these gains, our expectation would be a return to strong rates of payment in 2015 and beyond. But nevertheless, the capital gains are still quite low, so compared with our last couple of cycles, so there's quite a bit of upward pressure on these. But the pull forward last year was so massive that temporarily we expect to dampen things this year. But unfortunately, we don't have a lot of information yet. When we talk to our CPAs who deal with the high-income households and the big businesses, unfortunately, they haven't filled out any of their tax returns yet. They haven't actually started, and they won't for some time. And so we don't really have a lot of hard data. But, you know, reading the tea leaves, what we do have are these last quarter estimated payments. And in terms of this January-December estimated payment, to what extent on the margin are taxpayers perhaps anticipating a big bill or a small bill in April and adjusting their payments accordingly? And this weakness, as I explained in the December-January estimated payment, you see here flat for 2013 in Oregon, suggests that, well, maybe taxpayers might be pessimistic. So if you look here, it's just there's no model relationship here or any theoretical underpinning. But if you just looking at the past few years, our friends at DOR Research dug this up for me and showed that, well, it certainly seems that over the last few years, this December-January payment has been a decent indicator of whether we're going to get a large April payment. So this would support the flavor of our outlook. But this, again, is just the support. There's no theory here. It works great right now. But these sort of relationships can break down overnight and have it works today, might not work tomorrow. But nevertheless, it's one more reason to support this modest outlook in the near term in terms of the capital gains coming back. So here are the details. Here's 2013-15. Overall, we're looking at an increase of $20 million in available resources for the current biennium. Most of that comes, again, from the increased outlook, or the more optimistic outlook for job growth, and turns into personal income tax dollars, but that's offset, again, by the disappointing news we're seeing so far in terms of a handful of our revenue instruments. We've adjusted down corporate income taxes. We've given estate taxes a long-term downward adjustment as well. Cigarette taxes have been trailing the outlook in recent months, and court fees and video lottery are extremely weak. So as are estate taxes. Estate taxes and video lottery sales are, in recent months, are as low as they've been in years. And we're heading into the peak season for video lottery sales. We'll see if it holds up through then. And there, as Josh mentioned, there's some potential for some downside risk there as well. So here are the net changes over time with this... ignores 14.8 is the revenue change, the other influences on available resources for the current biennium. You see it stays in that range throughout the outlook. Our improvement in personal income taxes, the red bars, are offset by poor performance across the range of the other instruments. And finally, our long-term forecast hasn't changed. Again, we believe there's a lot of weight on state revenue instruments over the long term. We have an aging population. Not only does that slow growth, but it weakens our ability to extract revenue out of that growth. So over the long term, we have our biennial revenue growth hitting a steady state at about 10% growth per biennium. That's in comparison to 15 or above in the typical historical expansions for Oregon. So quite a bit weaker over the long extended horizon. So thanks with that. That's the end of our prepared comments, but we'd love to entertain any questions you might have.
Questions? Don't all ask at once. Yes, Senator.
Can you go back to the new slide that you have, page on 19, where you compare the estimated payments to non-wage income, and I'm being a little dense. I'm not quite understanding how this is calculated. So the first column there, where it has like a negative 28, negative 15, what is that in relationship to, the previous year?
Yes, I'm sorry. This is very poorly labeled. You're right. These are all growth rate year over year. So that's looking at December, January payments this year, 2013, December, 2014, January, so this is all related to the 2013 tax year. They make that final payment in January or December. and that is the growth relative to a year ago, so the 2012 tax year. And all, so that's similar across the board. The non-wage income would be looking at those tax returns.
That's actual then. The non-wage income and the Q2 final payments are the actual. So column one is what the individuals did on by January 31st, and the next two columns are what actually happened when they filed their returns between April and October.
Yeah, the only distinction would be the Senator George. The only distinction would be that non-wage income is what's coming off of these tax returns that they filed. The third column is a slightly different concept insofar as it's collections, what's coming in the door. So this is what we see in terms of personal income tax payments that aren't withholdings or aren't estimated payments in April, the typical April check. These are April checks, roughly.
So the way we read it is that you look at the year, that's what they did in January, and then the next two columns kind of give you an indicator of where those two columns come in. And what you're showing then is that when it's up, it's typically up, and when it's flat, it's typically flat. That's how that reads across.
Okay. Okay.
I'm sorry, I was being dense. I just was not.
Oh, it's very poorly. It's very poorly labeled.
Representative Conger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've lost the slide, but you were forecasting housing. I don't know whether it was starts or sales.
Starts.
Housing starts. And so just to make sure I understood that, it's your belief, you know, because the growth line kind of flattens and then continues up for Oregon. And I thought that was inconsistent. I know the label on the chart says short run stall. Why do you think it's a short-run stall? Do you think that the interest rate factors or the affordability factors are going to reverse themselves?
Yeah, Representative Conger. Yeah, the fundamental demand conditions are still really good in terms of housing. While interest rates are going up, housing is still affordable, and we're also seeing a household formation come back, in particular as a lot of the households that were forced to double up due to the recession or whatnot are now seeking their own single-family places. So we have affordability, we have additional household formation. You know, it appears that we do need some more supply in some of these areas. So there are fundamentals. Fundamentally, we're still in pretty good shape, and we're not nearly back to a trend rate of building yet. For the state, we're still well below both in terms of construction employment, housing starts, permits, construction put in place. Almost everything is well below what we would consider a steady state or a trend. So there's still some upward momentum over time. Now, whether or not that's a smooth recovery as we see here or has more fits and starts in it is yet to be determined.
Senator Conger,
follow up. That makes sense, and of course it's a forecast, right? So if the line's smooth or if it's dancing around a little bit, you would expect that it would move a little here and there. So no need for the disclaimer on that, I think. But I was curious with the that explains the housing starts, but you talked about lower than expected personal income tax collections. Senator George followed up about non-wage income, which is slowing down, at least measured by estimated tax payments, and then we had lower than expected corporate income tax payments. Did I get all of those correct?
Yes, Representative Conger.
Okay, so my question would be, how does that play into forecasting growth for the economy? Wouldn't those three things be indicators that maybe we might be turning the corner and heading the other way? I'm hoping you can explain it away, but when I heard those things, I thought that must be bad news, right? That must mean that the economy is slowing.
Yeah, Representative Conger, needless to say, Josh and I, who stare at these revenue numbers every day, have not been engulfed by the optimism that many of our advisors have over time. And that, and, it,
I,
and indeed,
I find that hard to picture. I'd like to see that day.
I'm glad to put it behind.
So would the rest of us, Representative Conger.
So, at any rate, but you make a very good point. And traditionally, when all of our little revenue instruments all start to perform better than expected or worse than expected all at once, traditionally that's been a very good or bad sign for future economic growth. I'm hoping this isn't the same sort of signal, but we really are getting what's termed in the office the cats and dogs, all the little revenues that we're forced to look at. They're really all turning in south, you know, or at least south of projections, and so this is certainly a concern going forward. But to date, we really haven't seen a whole lot of bad economic numbers to go with them. So there's some hope. It's just a revenue phenomenon.
Thank you. Representative Benz, please.
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mark, if you could go back to the slide that says hangover expected on 2013 tax returns. Is that black line reflective, in your opinion, of tax policy when it comes to capital gains, recognizing what's happened at the federal level?
Yes, Representative Benz, it very much is. This decrease of 5 or 6% you see here in terms of the capital gains on the tax return, so this is that Schedule D box in 2013 relative to 2012, we expect that to add up to be less than last year, despite almost 30% growth in the stock market. So this is obviously something that keeps us up at night. You know, are we right about the degree of this taxpayer behavior or not? And that it injects quite a bit of uncertainty into the outlook.
Right. Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yes, please.
And I was just looking at the line, the abrupt upward movement of the line in 14, 15, and 16. That's seems to be inconsistent with the fact that we now have a higher capital gains tax, or not? That's my question, I guess.
Oh, I see. Yes, Representative Bant. So there, it's consistent insofar as going from 2013 to 14, those will be the same tax environments. So hopefully it'll be driven by underlying gains. The problem is, we don't know how long, as I put here, hangover will last. Right? We know that. We depleted a lot of the stock of taxable gains out there before this tax event, and that stock was depleted twice before. After the tech bubble and the housing bubble, we saw a lot of these old-time gains get realized. So, to what extent is there, is there this pipeline of potential gains going forward? And we think it'll be smaller than in the past. We know that holding periods typically on our stocks have shrunk, so we feel that this is going to put downward pressure on our capital gains. We'll never get to the same point that we were at during the peak of the housing downturn here. You saw we got just south of $10 billion in capital gains at that point. Those dropped down to $2 billion at the worst of the recession. We're not going to get back up there, despite the fact, as you see here, the red bars, that the stock market, in terms of these general indices, is quite a bit higher. So it is a relatively pessimistic outlook insofar as capital gains, taxable capital gains relative to these equity growth is smaller than in the past. We're trying to tamp it down, but nevertheless, our models really want these capital gains to take off, just like they always have when the stock market takes off. And so that's what you're seeing here in these future tax years. Although it's less than in the past, but it's still very, very extreme in terms of growth rates.
Mr. Chair, if I may, it does look like we should all quickly go invest, judging from your projection of the Wilshire 5,000.
Make a ton of money on that.
Representative Vance, that's a good point. We take the Wilshire 5,000, of course, we take that from our national vendor so we can wash our hands of it. But there is clearly downside risk, and you see here we have put in a little bit of a pullback in the revenue outlook despite no continued growth expected in the stock market. I think there will be some correction. Hopefully it'll stay in the 10-15% range and we'll keep churning along.
Thank you.
Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to make sure I understand something you said, Mr. McMullen. When you referenced your cats and dogs earlier, and you said that those indicators are generally south, is it that the estimates are coming in lower than the projected growth, or that they are in real terms down?
Representative Bailey, thanks for the distinction. Typically, it's coming in less than the predicted growth for most of them. Now, some of them are down. The ones that, you know, are down would be the estate tax is down, the video lottery recently is down, and court fees are down. And that court fees is also extended throughout the future. We're understanding a little bit more about the impacts of the foreclosure mediation law is impacting our court fee, our series in unanticipated ways. We've worked that in now and explicitly have the foreclosures driving it going forward. So those three are going down, but for the most part, it's just slower than expected growth.
Yes, please.
Thank you for that clarification. I appreciate it. So I also want to make sure I understand then that income, for example, is up in a real sense, and that your forecast is generally conservative but includes in it some embedded expectations of additional labor force participation and other factors that may lead to future growth but haven't necessarily manifested in this time period. Is that correct?
That's correct, Representative Bailey. The increase in the forecast is largely speculative, unfortunately, relative to what's in the door. Now, we weight what's in the door more heavily than we do the outlook. But, yes, in terms of looking at forward-looking versus backward-looking, the backward-looking stuff is negative and the forward-looking stuff is positive.
Thank you.
Thank you. I have a couple of questions. I want to ask the one that somebody always asks, and that is, given your forecast, that's a number or a set of numbers added together, what's the relative risk up or down that you're wrong? We always ask you that question. Last time you answered it in different ways than you did the time before. What's your thought now?
Well,
is the risk of more income to the state greater or lower than the risk of less income to the state?
Yeah, well, the risk that we're wrong is 100%. So that's,
well, of course, we understand that. I do think that was my point last time we talked.
Representative Barnhart, that's correct. And right now, my worry for this tax year is on the upside. I think that obviously you're never out of the woods in terms of a recession. A shock could happen tomorrow. But it would it's going to take a while to manifest itself in terms of our tax revenue. So I think we'll probably be okay for the current biennium in terms of the downside risk managing this current biennium. Upside risk, it is a little bit more of a concern, particularly in this tax year. This timing, as you see here with these capital gains, we could have more this April and less next April than we're expecting here, which could cause, you know, some issues. So I think that there's clearly a lot of upside risk, and it makes us particularly uncomfortable given that we're now about $100 million away from the personal income tax kicker threshold, which is very little breathing room on the upside.
Expect a question from the press on that issue later. My second area of interest is back to the chart that you discussed with Senator George. And I'm looking at the first column, well, the second column, the one that contains the percentage numbers. My recollection is that our concern a year ago was that the federal government, or actually the concern just before a year ago, was that the federal government was monkeying with its tax system, and therefore people were trying to move income into 12 and away from 13. Have I remembered that correctly?
Representative Barnhart, yes, that's true, and that's why we saw 25% growth in this April payments last April. Luckily, that was in the outlook, so it didn't result in any kind of budget turmoil. We had 25% growth in the outlook, and luckily enough, it came to pass.
Right.
But this downside is
just as risky as was that upside guess.
Right, and of course, my comment, and please feel free to respond to it, is that your worry at that point was that because it was robbing income from 13, that income from 13 would be significantly depressed, or might be significantly depressed. But now you're showing us that income from 13 was, at least in the December, January payments, was essentially flat. So something must have happened positively in 13 that got us to the point where we made up for that early payment in 12.
Oh, yes, Representative Barnard. Yeah, that's true. It gets messy when we turn into these payments because they reflect more than just the capital gains in particular, and more than just one tax year. As you see here, we expect the non-wage component of income, the red part being our forecast, is expected to drop in 2013 relative to 2012, yet we still have some growth in final payments. Well, those final payments reflect more than just non-wage income. They have some wage income in there as well, and they reflect some of 2012 and 2011. And as we processed the tax returns for 2012, we found out there was more capital gains then. Well, not all of that has been paid yet, all of that liability. So a lot of that collection story is a little messier when we get to that right column because there's a lot of moving parts, a lot of different years, and a lot of different things that other than the capital gains and the non-wage income itself. But the qualitative story is in the center column where we do believe that this non-wage income is going to pull back. We'll still see growth in personal income taxes because the wages are so big because, the job, what comes out of paychecks is very important in size.
Great. Thank you. And then my last question or set of questions has to do with the reasons why corporate receipts are lower. And I recall several times you have talked about corporate tax receipts in relation to the corporate business cycle and how, at least at one time recently, the receipts were not very good, but it was because corporations were investing heavily in the economy. I take it that's not your argument this time for why receipts from corporations aren't that great.
Representative Barnard, it is a theory, and it's the one that I hope is true, that as businesses expand and they hire and they invest, this brings down their profits and brings down their tax burden. To date, we haven't seen the underlying profit series drop. Now, it's not always associated with the taxable profits, but given that we haven't seen that cooling off in corporate profits nationwide, I don't know how much that's part of the story, and I'm worried about perhaps some more negative reasons for it. Unsure exactly what all those are. Refunds are difficult. They reflect corporations' payments in relationship to what they expected, and the corporate tax environment has changed a lot over the last 5 or 6 years, so some of the refunds might just have to do with the CPAs catching up with Oregon law.
Right. My last question goes back to chart, or actually it's illustrated in your page 15, and I just simply want to make certain I understand the way in which you reflect these numbers. If I understand it correctly, look at interest at the bottom, for example. It shows a very significant loss in the recession, and I take it that the dark bar is actually a very long bar, even though it only shows a little sliver there, and that we're only up slightly from that bottom. I think that's what this means. Have I got that right?
Correct, Representative Barnett.
And then compare that to Secretary of State fees, that were down only a little bit from their high, but now they're up quite a lot above their high. Have I understood this chart correctly then when I use those as illustrations?
Yes, Reverend, that's absolutely true. Secretary of State fees, due to the change in the legislation, showed only very slight decline during the recession and are now over twice the size they were heading in.
Thank you. I think I now understand this graph and several others that you represented the same way. That's helpful. Senator Rosenbaum?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to ask a little more about the employment picture that was reflected here. And I know, I don't think it was in your slides, but that it's been reported that we have the third fastest job growth in the nation now. And you had a breakdown by industry. And can you say a little more about where in Oregon the job growth is happening? And then on the unemployment numbers coming down, you said something that puzzled me, that that's good news, but it's also a reflection of people leaving the workforce. And who, I don't know who those people are, because I thought people were coming back into the workforce as there were more jobs available.
Yeah, Senator Rosenbaum, we expect that to happen. To date, it really hasn't. And like I say, there's reasons why this is, the labor force response is very delayed relative to the job growth itself. It takes a while before the job growth makes workers scarce. Once workers become scarce, they get paid more. Once they get paid more, people come in. So we've got the first step in that. We've seen the job growth now. Workers are becoming more scarce. We're down to a 7% unemployment rate, but they're not. But that trend is somewhere around 6-6.5% when we get to a normally functioning economy. So we're not quite there yet, but we expect to be. The labor force losses to date continue, and that's what's creating some of this decline in the unemployment rate, which is defined as the ratio of the number of jobs to number of workers. If the number of workers fall, it affects the unemployment rate, or the number of people without jobs, rather, to the number of workers. So that's still to come. We hope, and I think it's pretty compelling that it will. Now, in terms of growth across the state, Josh has actually put together some good numbers on which industries have done the heavy lifting.
For the industries, Senator Rosenbaum, we're seeing the largest job gains are coming from the large service sector, so professional business services. That includes all of your consulting firms and your attorneys, and it also includes things like call centers and the like. So there's a wide range of spectrums of occupations within that. So we're getting from that and leisure and hospitality, and those are the two, and then health services, the doctors and the nurses primarily. Those are the three leading the largest job growth in terms of gains. Which ones have improved the most from the bottom are a lot of actually our goods producing industries. Metals and machinery, our manufacturing subsector, has improved considerably relative to where they were. They're not all the way back, but they made really good progress. Our mining and logging has actually improved quite a bit. Granted, they're also not all the way back. They've only gained back maybe 1,000 or 2,000 loggers, and so they're still down considerably. But those are the ones that have driven the most improvement. In terms of the regional impact, Portland has gained about 20,000 or so jobs on a year-over-year basis pretty consistently for the last 3 years. Some of the graphs earlier showed the statewide numbers went up to 35, 40,000 jobs per year at an annual pace or so. All of those have come from Bend and Medford predominantly, now a little bit here in Salem. But all the other regions have added just a little bit of jobs, but that's what's the regions really driving the job growth today would be those four. So Portland's the dominant one, then Bend, Medford, and Salem. That's where all the job growth is occurring predominantly today.
And just to follow up, Mr. Chair, do you have any kind of breakdown between small business versus larger businesses? I assume the service sector jobs are mostly small businesses, but I don't know that that's true.
Senator Rosenbaum, the Employment Department does have the data broken down by firms, and you're right, the leisure and hospitality in particular, we have smaller than average size firms there, measured by employees per establishment.
Thanks.
Thank you. Representative Davis, please.
Thank you, Chair, and thanks very much for your presentation. It's always interesting. I also want to point people in particular to your blog, which is one of the best blogs on Oregon economic analysis in the state, so thanks for that. I believe it was in your fourth quarter forecast last year, you had a fantastic graph about this, comparing this economic recovery to, I think, the last 10 or 15. And the moral that I took away was that this has continued to be a slow recovery and that the job growth percentage was low relative to previous recoveries. Could you touch on that and where that stands now compared to where we were 3 months ago?
Sure, Representative Davis. What we've done is, in In a typical recovery, Oregon in the past has gotten to job growth of 3.5% when we're humming in the mature expansion as we are now. What we've done in this particular outlook is we've increased our growth rate from 2.1 or 2% to 2.5% for briefly over the next year or two. So we're not getting back to what we're accustomed to, but nevertheless, a little bit of acceleration, a half a percent in terms of our employment growth. Again, about 6,000 jobs over the rest of the biennium is what we're talking about here. But that doesn't affect the overall picture. The graph you have in your mind still tells us it'll be sometime probably early next year before we return to our pre-recession peak. Not for Portland, though. Portland, it'll be a news story here in a couple months. 1 or 2 months now, Portland will reach that past peak.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you. Other questions?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative Conger.
Jump in with one more question. I think last time you were here, I asked about the impact of the Affordable Care Act implementation. To what extent does the forecast for jobs take into account the further delay in the employer mandate, changes that we hear about anecdotally in employer behavior, both in terms of hiring and in structuring their workforce to be part-time, for smaller mid-sized companies?
Yeah, Representative Conger, macroeconomic outlook that we take from our vendor, in their narrative, they say they're making some adjustments for this. In the numbers, it's hard to see them. So in terms of feeding through the outlook, we have little direct impact put in there now. But that said, we're watching it closely in terms of a couple of things. One is employment in the healthcare sector, hospitals versus ambulatory care. And the other thing, of course, is part-time workers. To what extent folks are working part-time for economic reasons. To date, because we have the business cycle in there, we're seeing folks working part-time who would like to work full-time. That number of people is dropping, but that has a lot to do with the underlying economic expansion. We'll take a closer look at those numbers when this employer mandates comes into play, and see if we see any sort of increase in that part-time. What that would do in terms of the economic forecast or the revenue forecast is to say, okay, that's going to lower our overall wage picture relative to the number of jobs. So if we have the same number of jobs, we'll have fewer wages, which would result in less personal income tax. But we'll wait to see any impact in the data, see if we do see an increase in people who are working part-time that don't want to. And if that's the case, we'll weed it through into the revenue forecast.
Just one quick follow-up. In case you didn't see it, there was Congressional Budget Office, which is a nonpartisan federal legislative agency, came out with a projection that I think showed would expect about 2.5 million. I'm not sure if I correctly stated, say fewer people in the workforce or fewer people in full-time jobs, and that information I think is only a couple of days old. So the other factor, I guess, that could come into play would be more people dropping out of the workforce.
Yes, Representative Conner, I'm familiar with that study. I did some time at CBO myself.
You didn't come through unscathed. I can see that by the pain in your voice.
the main rationale behind that is yes. In the current system, folks have to have a job in order to have affordable insurance. When they can have affordable insurance without a job, then fewer people will want to participate in the labor market force. That's the dynamic there.
Thank you. Other questions? We very much appreciate the work that you do to pull these forecasts together for us and to present them. Again, thank you very much for bringing them to us, and we very much appreciate it.
No, thanks for having me.
We'll see you in 3 months. 3.5 months, yes. Thank you. Paul, you have another topic for us.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. As I mentioned at the beginning of the meeting, we have gone through, and Day, I'll ask Day to come to the witness stand. Day has been working hard over the last couple of weeks to update the local formula revenue estimates, and those are in OLIS. Estimates are the last time we went through this exercise and worked with Department of Education and DAS and others was when you developed your 2013 close of session budget for the state school fund. So this is an update for the first time since last spring. So we've got a year's worth of data. So unlike the forecast, we don't do this on a regular quarterly basis. We do it annually. And, of course, the key factor is the property tax revenue that comes in. And Day has put together, as you can see on the screen there in your OLIS, updated figures of the components for the local revenue. Just remind you that local revenue is about 35% of formula revenue. And while certain districts may receive stronger property tax growth, the formula allocates that throughout the state. So this revenue would be additional revenue that we did not anticipate a year ago that's going to be available in the formula for the biennium, for this year and next year. So, Dan.
Chair Bernhard, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. For the record, this is Dave Back, Legislative Revenue Office. This is a local revenue update for school districts and ESDs, Education Service Districts. As Paul summarized, a lot of data come on an annual basis, so we're much more handicapped than the state economists in updating this local revenue forecast. As Paul mentioned, local revenue is about one-third of formula revenue to be distributed to school districts and education service districts. The rest, two-thirds, come from the state school fund, most of it from general fund, some from lottery funds. 2013 legislature appropriated $6.55 billion to the state school fund. During the special session, the legislature added $100 million more to 14-15 school year. So altogether, state school fund is $6.65 billion at this point. Billion, that is. The bottom line, as you see, additional local revenue for the formula increased, well, estimated, of course, $98 million. Remember that 95% of local revenues are from property taxes and about 3% from common school fund. So this increase is a consequence of unexpected, in some counties, that is, a large increase in property taxes, together with a one-year extension of federal forest fees and additional distribution to common school fund for 14-15. So let me explain how we arrive at this additional local revenue for the school formula. So for 13-14 property tax year, for school districts and ESDs, on a permanent rate basis, the imposed tax increased 3.2%. Now, last year, we used 1.3% growth for 13-14. And for 14-15, we used 1.7% growth forecast. In the beginning of last year, actually, when we projected local revenue, we had to lower local revenue forecast by about $60 million from prior year. we're not optimistic at all about the property taxes. Things have changed, and things have changed quite a bit for some property tax-rich counties. Statewide, 3.2% growth of property taxes for school districts and education service districts, but the counties are different, and while most counties registered about 1 to 3% property tax growth, there are some counties where there are negative growth still, like Malheur, Lake, Klamath, and Gilliam, still negative. But some property tax rich counties like metro area, they registered substantially high growth. Local conditions are very important. Some counties will see, they saw an increase in real market value. Along with that, assessed value increased sharply. A county saw an end of urban renewal agency, and access values were returned to taxing districts. So all in all, the Washington County saw 3.8% growth, Multnomah 3.5%. Representative Berger and I live in Polk County. We had only 1.1% growth. Again, most counties show a 1 to 3% growth in property taxes. Clackamas saw close to 5%, the Deschutes over 5%. Again, local conditions are very important for these growth. So with that, we increased property tax increase forecast for 14-15 to about 3.3%. Now, the variables that we consider in projecting 3.3 for 14-15 is housing starts, of course. We have tremendous growth in 12-13, so new properties will be placed on tax rolls. That will help. We'll have a lot of properties growing at 3% assessed growth rate. And the great majority of counties will perform better as their local housing market conditions improve. And that's the underlying assumption. And at the same time, some of the extraordinary incidents in some counties, like boosting property taxes, will disappear in 14-15 and going forward. For 13-14, actually, there was 1 year extension of federal forest fees, so it adds about $11 million to local revenue. And because of substantial improvement in common school fund balance in 2013, we're going to see about $7 to $8 million more distribution to schools in 14-15 year. So if we break down increase in local revenues in fiscal years, 13-14, we're going to see about $38 million more. And then 14-15 school year, we're going to see about $60 million more. So altogether, it's $98 million for 13-15. I have, if there's any questions.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is really exciting news. And if I'm looking at the materials correctly that you have in here, it's great news for my district, about $618,000 for kids in my district, yeah, and $4.6 million in additional funds for Portland Public Schools for next school year.
That's the chart that I'm going to review shortly. But yes, I have prepared 14-15 school finance distribution.
Well, before we get to that, then, are there other questions on the material that he's already presented? Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't quite know how to ask this question, but I'm trying to kind of assess the relative health of the county. So you have Clackamas County and Deschutes County going up over 5% with their property tax, which is higher than the average. And then you have other counties that have smaller numbers, but with Clackamas and Deschutes, well, maybe not Clackamas, but with Deschutes, they'd been so hard hit by the recession, and other counties had been maybe not hit as hard. So which counties are the net are doing the best in the net sense of it? In other words, they didn't do so bad in the recession, and they've done relatively well in this latest forecast.
Chair Barnard, Chair Burdick, yes. Some of the counties that led the housing recovery, like Deschutes County, they saw a substantial increase in real market value. And for a while, a lot of properties had assessed value the same as real market value.
No, my question is, which counties are in a net sense? In other words, some counties went really crashed, like Deschutes County during the recession.
Jackson, yes.
And Jackson. So when they come up 5%, they're still not at a level of a county that, you see what I'm saying?
So
in a net sense, which counties are doing the best?
I'm operating with very high level aggregate data at this point. DOR is still putting together detailed tables, but what I can tell you is, for example, Deschutes County, with increased real market value, it's far below its peak real market value at this point.
Right. And what about the other counties that are doing, like Washington, Multnomah, the metro counties, Clackamas?
That I will have to investigate a little more.
Yeah, I'd be interested in that information. Thank
yes.
you.
So if I can add a little more. The counties that led housing recovery, they're the ones that saw more increase in property taxes than other counties. The Deschutes being one, but Jackson actually saw less than 3% growth, though. Some of the coastal counties, some high twos, but most of Willamette Valley counties, Lane about 2.4, Marion about 2.8. Polk County saw only minimal growth, but across the river in Marion County, a much better increase. So all the counties are a little different, and I'll check relative to peak real market value, how does it fare at this point? Yeah.
And I understand we'll have data from the department by mid-year.
Yes.
And so we'll make sure that that's on our list of interim committee issues.
Yes, sir.
At that time. Representative Davis.
Thank you, Chair, and thanks for the presentation. I can understand the growth, for example, in Clackamas County. When you talk about counties that are experiencing only 1% growth, for example, Polk, many folks assume it's always going to be a 3% growth rate under our current system. But can you explain why we might see only 1% in some of those areas?
So for some counties who are increasing rather substantially, some of the new properties are being placed on tax rolls, and that helps. Yeah. On the other hand, a lot of counties still, the properties are underwater. That is, they're real market values are actually assessed values. And unless real market value increases sharply, the assessed value will not increase much. And also, there's a combination of residential properties and commercial and industrial a mix. Mm-hmm. So when commercial and industrial doesn't do well, then that'll affect also total property taxes. Yes.
Follow up. And many of us often forget that personal property and business personal property are involved in this, so that when a business goes out of business, that personal property is no longer going to be on the roll, property tax rolls.
Chair Bernhardt, Representative Davis, yes, and being a business owner, I'm pretty well aware of that.
Okay. Thank you. Why don't you go ahead to the distribution, unless there's
other
questions. To the distribution chart, and you'll note that's also in OLIS.
So this chart shows school finance distribution for 14-15. Now, this is based on about 60 million more to 14-15 school year out of local revenue. Of course, state school fund is 6.65 billion. And all the carve-outs are accounted for. Now this is the amount of money that is distributed based on formula. So this revenue is anticipated additionally for school districts. Of course, ESDs will get a little more too, about 2 to 3 million. So per ADMW basis, there will be additional $87 per ADMW. So, for example, Representative Gasser, Corvallis would get a little over $600,000 more, and Philomath, $158,000. It's all based on ADMW, and so my county, Salem-Keizer, will see about 4.2 million more, and Multnomah, Portland School District will get 4.7 million more. Out of total ADMW, the Portland School District is about 8.2% of total ADMW. Salem-Keizer is about 7.3%. Now, this ADMW, this is a projection by ODE. This doesn't incorporate new poverty wage at this point. So ODE anticipates a little more increase in ADMW because of new poverty wage, about 6,000 to 7,000 more. So they'll push down this per ADMW figure a little bit, but based on January school data and based on February local revenue estimate, this is what we have. So per ADMW, $87 more. And that's good news.
Thank you. Questions?
Mr. Chair.
Madam Chair.
Just how the formula works. Okay, you may not be the right person to ask the question, but when the property tax goes up like this, does that money actually go to the school districts, or are the school districts limited to the amount that the legislature appropriated?
The state school fund stays the same. It's appropriated by the legislature and will be out to school districts and ESDs no matter what. Now, counties collect this property taxes and will be distributed to taxing districts, including school districts and ESDs. ODE will incorporate this information, and out of state school fund, state school finance coordinator will add this per ADMW, $87, in their calculation in distributing money.
What I'm trying to get at, will the school districts actually see another $87 ADMW beyond what the legislature appropriated.
Yes, 14, 15, yes. And for 13, 14, because we're talking about $38 million, about two-thirds of these figures will show up in their 13, 14 revenue distribution. So this is looking forward 14, 15, but 13, 15, 13, 14, yes, there will be 38 million more, and about two-thirds of these revenues will show up in the distribution in schools and ESDs.
Does anyone have any question about how that actually works? I mean, I think of it as a really two different systems. The property tax system works completely independently, and then the state fund fills in on top.
Yes.
And so if a school district receives a lot more property tax than we had thought, the effect of that is to spread state dollars away from that school district toward everybody else. And that's why you end up with a number that's almost uniform in your distribution sheet.
Yes, sir.
Because the districts that received a lot more money from the property tax will get fewer dollars from the state. But overall, there'll be more dollars available for all of the students in the state. Have I got that right?
Chair Barnhart, exactly.
Right. Yes. So because we have these two completely separate systems that interact with each other, that's why we get this kind of result.
Yeah, it's based on the equity that you defined.
Right, and I think that deals with the question that you asked. Anything else? Really appreciate the report. We look forward to hearing more about the property tax issues, including the question that I don't think quite got asked, but I'm sure the Department of Revenue will be telling us about mid-year. And that is how much room is there left under the assessed value to actually get these 5% increases in the future or more? And how much, and are we getting back to the point where in most places we're back up to the assessed value and therefore we're at the 3% increase level?
Along those lines.
Not a question for today, yes.
Yeah, and I'm very interested in the answer to that as well.
Yeah.
Do you have kind of an off-the-cuff estimate of how many counties actually fell below the measure 50 and will be basically reset at their lower market value?
Chair Barnhart, Chair Burdick, I'm afraid not. I don't.
Yeah, that's what we expect to get from the department about mid-year, and right. I suspect...
We know some of them. We know Deschutes, and we know Jackson, but I was just interested in
right. you. And, of course, based on the income tax numbers that we got, we can tell that some of these counties, while they've grown a lot, haven't gotten back to pre-recession levels on income side. They probably haven't on property either. Is there anything else for this morning? Now, for the House Committee on Revenue, we will be finished for the day. My understanding is the Senate Committee has additional business this afternoon. And with that, the House Committee on Revenue is adjourned for today.
And the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee will stand in recess until 1 o'clock this afternoon.
Yeah, we usually work hard.